Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And I apologize, I've been holding up this process during the day, so I'm going to try to be a little faster. Mr. Chairman, the next unit is Unit 462 on page 68. This is the out-of-home placement for children, which are primarily the foster care kids in DFS custody that are covered by Medicaid. And there is no exception request for this unit, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Looking at the statistics, are you just seeing that steady kind of growth?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there has been growth in the unit. Our actual costs have gone down, so yeah. It kind of balances things off. And I do want to note that there are some children in this program, less than 10%, that actually are not in DFS or do not qualify for the Medicaid match. I should say.
Okay, Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the table on page 70, and I note that there's like a $10 million increase from the base budget to the standard budget. What's that from?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wallace, through the net to zero process, what we're trying to do is trying to make the standard budget reflect the actual expenditures. So one of the things that we did is we have medical costs related to these children. And originally this budget only had the out-of-home placement costs and not the medical costs. So we've taken the medical cost out of the children's budget and moved it to this budget so you know what the full cost is for this program.
It's not an increase.
Where did the money come from then?
It came from 046. One.
And that name of that is?
Medicaid Children Services.
Oh, okay. We just go over that one. We just had that
one. We just went past that.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the next unit starts on page 71. That's Nursing Facility Services. Again, this covers primarily the Medicaid-eligible individuals that are in nursing facilities. And there is no exception request to this budget, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Okay. I think we're just going to take a time out for about another minute. I might go on a reconnaissance mission.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask a quick question on the previous budget. We're talking about foster care. I just had a curiosity question about, this only funds them until they're 18, or do we have anything that, any programs that fund, say, between 18 and 21, or a foster out program that assists them with maybe going to college or job placement?
Mr. Chairman, I'm hearing from the gallery back here that actually some individuals can qualify for services up to age 21.
Is that through the absence of Mr. Chairman, through you or DFS?
Mr. Chairman, for the medical services, they'd be the Department of Health. For any services, other services, that would probably be under DFS. I am personally aware of a program in Cheyenne. I think they have them in other communities where when a foster care child graduates from high school, they have some transition services for them that would take them to 21, but that the actual services are provided by DFS.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are you still on page 73? Or we haven't got to that quite yet?
We went back to 0462, so we're still on 0463.
You're still, okay, so we're just getting ready to start nursing facility. I know Senator Meyer as an interest in others. But okay, so we're on starting 0463, page 71, 2, and 3. Correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, Director Porzlin, just a general question on this. Have we seen any changes relative to availability of long-term care facilities around the state? I mean, I assume we're seeing a steady increase in demand as the boomers start getting to that age, I guess, where they need long-term care. But what about the availability of facilities around the state? Is that growing along with the demand?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, nursing homes across the state are in varying stages of fiscal health, and some of them are certainly closer to ceasing operation than others. There is part of the problem is the fact that there hasn't been a rate increase, as I mentioned earlier this morning, in 7 years from Medicaid. Obviously, they're not all Medicaid patients, but if I remember my statistics, it's somewhere upper 60s, low 70% of the residents in nursing homes are paid for with Medicaid within Wyoming. So I can't make a generalized statement that everything is wonderful and everything is dire. It's just a matter of where you are in the state and what the mix is between their Medicaid patient and their private pay. But I'm convinced that we need to do something in terms of rates, and hopefully out of the long-term care study that is underway as part of the Medicaid reform, that a recommendation will be coming to you to make some adjustments.
Okay. You have a follow-up?
No.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, in that long-term care study, is that going to include some of the alternative care mechanisms rather than nursing homes as far as assistance in-home, and it covers the whole gamut? Is that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, absolutely. When you're talking about long-term care, we're just not talking about one part of it, which is nursing homes. We're talking about the full array of services that Medicaid participates in, and we, as I mentioned this morning, there's a steering committee, but then there's four task force working in different areas. And so I expect a series of recommendations coming out of that addresses in-home services as well as nursing home services.
Thank you, Mr. Jerk. Mr. Chairman, I guess with an aging parent, I'm becoming more and more aware of a lot of the things that are going on in that area, so if you could keep me up to speed or if there's anything I can do as far as learning more or helping out, I'm actually knowing what's kind of going on, so it's that's a change, huh, Mr. Director?
Okay, next, I think it's...
Mr. Chairman, next unit is on page 74. That's a new unit called Hospice. This was created due to a bill that was passed in the last session allowing Medicaid to pay a general fund portion for private hospice days. Medicaid can provide hospice in a nursing facility, hospice care and nursing facility, but they couldn't, under rule, Medicaid can't pay for a private facility. So that bill was passed. So what we did was, and part of that bill was that I think it was a JAC recommendation that we actually create a unit for that. So what we did was we moved what we estimate to be our total hospice care for the division to this unit.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, and it's probably my fault, but anyway, I have, you know, I'm talking to a couple of some of the Medicaid folks around the state, and it's really making a great difference. Excuse me, the hospice people around the state, and it's really making a great difference and a positive impact for them. But nevertheless, the I just wondering. I mean, one of the reasons or one of the issues that was kind of behind this was the fact that in the end, the hospice care should save some money with respect to the transition that happens there, as opposed to the end of life treatment that we have. And I'm just wondering, as to do this, I mean, was, you know, the impression I had and the information I had indicated it should be relatively cost neutral. And I'm just, is there any way that we know from either folks that are in hospital care or in nursing home care to track the expenses or know what the expenses are in the last, say, 60 days of a person's life and the amount of medical care that they receive in either a hospital or a nursing home facility?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, there has been certainly national studies done on that, and you've seen those numbers. They're astronomical about what percentage of the expenditures that you make in your lifetime, how much of that occurs within the last few months of a person's life. And so I'm not aware of anything that we've done at the state of Wyoming level on that.
Mr. Chairman, the only reason I was following up on that was just, I mean, in the end, I really, if there's any way for us to know, not just from the feel about it, but empirically, if this really does works as advertised, and if, I mean, it's right now it's not worth doing extra, but if that information's available, it'd be interesting to see it. But if it's not available, I don't think worth setting up anything in particular to see if it really is working as advertised.
We'll certainly take a look at it, and as this moves forward, we'll see how much this is utilized.
And Mr. Chairman, yeah, and Senator Perkins, I was one of the co-sponsors on that bill, and I think it was some really good legislation. And looking at Riverton and the impacts of what's going on in our hospice in Riverton, I just got to believe it's a positive impact not only for the people, which is obviously one of the biggest reasons we did it, but in terms of neutrality. And you look at the cost and what's going on, and some people have been in there. It's not like they're there for 6, 7, 8, 9 days. Some have been there for a considerably longer period of time, and the cost to our system would have been much more. So I agree with Senator Perkins when we look at that. I think not only will it be neutral, we'll probably be saving money ultimately. And that'd be great to know if we could figure out how to determine that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the next unit starts on page 76, and that is optional services adult. This covers all of the Medicaid services that are not required under federal regulations that the state of Wyoming has decided to include in their benefit plan. So the biggest component of this is prescription drugs. This is where you'll find prescription drugs for adults. And there are a number of other services that are listed in the narrative. There is not an exception request for this unit, and the governor did approve the standard budget as submitted.
Mr. Chairman, how long have we been doing this one?
Mr. Chairman,
a long time.
Mr.
Long
Co-Chair, time. It precedes me. It's been probably
nothing precedes.
Mr. Chairman, the optional service has probably been since the inception of the state plan. Over the years, we've probably added services to that over time. Perhaps like transplants or something like that may have been added at some point in time, but the actual program itself was probably included in the original state Medicaid plan.
Mr. Chairman, how many roughly are affected by this in our state? Do you have a number roughly? Is it like thousands and thousands, or?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, it is very likely that many of the adult participants, there are 32,000 adults in the Medicaid program, have probably used one of these services at some point in time. Because I think, for example, I think ambulance, is ambulance in here? Yeah. So like an ambulance, if they've used an ambulance in their entire time on Medicaid, it would be here.
Yeah.
But Bob, I'm just wondering, why is our base budget so high compared to our standard budget? How do we get a base budget that's $37 million and standard budget's $11
Mr. Chairman, again, through the net to zero process, we tried to move expenditures that applied to specific groups out of this budget to other budgets. And the other thing that, that has happened here is that we get a rebate, a manufacturer's rebate from prescription drugs, which is pretty significant each year. And that used to be in another unit. We moved that credit into this unit, and that's primarily the big piece that reduced this amount.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I guess for budgeting purposes, next year when we come back in, the base budget is going to be closer to the standard budget that we have today, so if we net to zero, we rebalance the base budget. So is that how it's going to work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, it should.
Okay, thank you.
I can't predict will happen between now and then, but as a general rule, in this budget, we did attempt to try to clean up and we'll get to some other examples in the adult waivers, another example where we moved the prescription drugs that were in this unit to the adult waiver so we could capture all of the waiver costs instead of having it be piecemeal, you know, part of this budget, part of another budget, and part of another budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Perkins. Does this provide any benefit when you talk about non-covered drugs? Is it drugs that are, just not covered under D, that otherwise wouldn't be covered under D? Is there any donut hole coverage with respect to dual eligible people that are available under this?
I can't answer that. Mr. Chairman, let me just kind of, and Senator Perkins, let me try to restate what you're asking. What you're asking is, with some of the coverage on the Medicare Part D, there's a donut hole there. Does that apply here? And my understanding is it does not.
So these are just for drugs that wouldn't be covered that are just not covered under the federal plan, and we help. And I understand there's other things besides prescriptions, but you said the majority of this was prescription drugs that aren't covered under the other federal programs, and if we're doing this for the state.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I think a fair way to say that is that the Medicare Part D only applies to dual-eligible individuals, adults that are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. This unit would pick up all the non-dual-eligibles primarily who are not eligible for Medicare Part D coverage. Moving on, Mr. Chairman, the next unit is on page 79. This is Indian Health Services. These are the services that are provided by the Indian Health Service in Fremont County, and these are 100% matched federal funds, so feds pay 100% of these costs, and the governor has recommended approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, are you going to speak about the? Are you going to talk about Medicaid expansion to the tribes at some point in time? I know that's one of the select committees by the legislature is recommending that. Were you planning on discussing that issue?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, I hadn't planned on it, but I'd be happy to. I received a letter from the Tribal Relations Committee encouraging me to expand Medicaid to tribal members who are adults, generally speaking. I informed them that the legislature has prohibited the Department of Health from expanding any portions of the Medicaid program, and I have to have specific direction by the legislature or authorization. As a result, that is not in our budget, and we are not making that that proposal because you as a legislature have said no to expansion, and you as a legislature have said Department of Health cannot expand on its own. So we're sitting here just waiting for what the legislature wants to do in terms of any of the expansion.
Mr. Chairman, okay. Thanks for listening to what we wanted to do, and we appreciate that. Question I have is, and I'm not saying I don't want to get into that direction. I wouldn't support doing it now either. But what I want to know is, can you do it incrementally? Is it all or none? Could you do it incrementally?
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Bebout, it is our understanding that CMS is not going to permit partial expansion.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, moving on, the next unit is on page 81. That is the Life Resource Center. This covers the services provided at the Life Resource Center that are eligible for Medicaid payment. We do not have an exception request for this unit, and the governor has recommended approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Senator Meyer.
Question, if there was an expansion, would we, this population that's already served by the waiver, could it be rolled into the expansion numbers and we'd get 100% funding rather than 50% funding?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, no. This population is already eligible for Medicaid, so consequently they cannot be eligible to get the higher rate of FMAP.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we still on the WLRC? If there's savings, and I know that this has occurred in the Health Committee where they're talking about savings made here would stay within the behavioral health and wouldn't be shifted out. Are you familiar? You recall those conversations with the Health Committee? And my question is, how would you feel about a footnote that might say that if we save money anywhere in behavioral health, that the money is spent in behavioral health? I think there's some concerns by some people that savings made in that one area, one part of it, like WLRC, would go to the other part of it, would be the community providers. How would you feel about that?
Mr. Chairman.
Or is that something you're going to be doing anyway?
Senator Bebald, I don't recall that discussion. We presented the plan to or the study to the committee. They made asked a few questions, and then we went on to the next topic, and as I recall. So I don't recall that conversation. Now, in terms of what to do with the savings, ultimately I think that would be a call that the legislature could make.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, we'll think more about that, Tom, and how you feel about it, give you a chance to digest it. Maybe it's not a good idea. I just wanted to throw it out there.
Mr. Chairman, one thing I would caution the committee is that we put out the recommendations, but I don't want people to start spending that money before we even get there because, as I mentioned this morning, is we've got positions that are filled, and unless you direct layoffs, then we're going to have to wait for the attrition to take place. So that's not going to be an overnight windfall that can be spent somewhere else.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, moving on, the next unit is on page 83, and that's the Medicaid payments for the Wyoming State Hospital. The Wyoming State Hospital no longer qualifies for Medicaid payments at this point in time, so we moved those federal funds to a different unit, Unit 483, because we thought felt like we had a shortfall there, so we've pretty much eliminated this unit. It's only $231,000. Okay, and we'll skip through the next three, Mr. Chairman. Next is on page 85. And that is the DD adult waiver. I think everyone knows what that's for. The governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted, but there is an exception request.
Mr. Chairman, the request is for $9.7 million, roughly, for this program, of which it'd be 50% funded with general funds, 50% funded with federal funds. This would reduce the waiting list, which as of September 30 was 234 adults were on the waiting list at that point in time. That would fund 172 of those individuals. And essentially that would be, the 172 are those people who have been on the waiting list for 18 months or longer. And the vast majority of these people would be put onto the support waiver, of which we talked about this morning, the support waiver costs and then the medical costs of $19.7 for the support waiver and the $65.60 for the medical cost. Without the reform taking place, and if we had the same amount of money, we could only take 69 people off the waiting list. That's a that as opposed to 172. So essentially, it would be 103 less people who would come off the waiting list as a result of that. Because as Bob mentioned this morning, the average cost, and again, this is average cost for a comprehensive waiver is $64,583. However, of that amount, total amount, we would set aside $660,000 of it for emergency replacements for people who would have to have comprehensive waiver services. So of that 172 individuals, we think that it could end up with a comprehensive waiver there or another one coming in, and so we would reserve $660,000. Just as a side note, is the average time for an adult on a waiver is 14.3 years within the state.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
So what's the status of our waiver with the feds? Is it, have we had any idea of when it'll be accepted? Where are we in that process?
It has been submitted to CMS. CMS is reviewing it, and the way the process works is you submit it, they send you a series of questions. We respond to them. They look at our response, and they send back more questions, and it goes back and forth. And every time a question takes place, then the clock stops and until the responses come in. And then it can starts up again. So this could take some time. The current waiver ends in June of next year. And so we hope to have the approval in advance, and we can start to do the transition starting in the spring. If not, then we'll have to ask for an extension to the federal government for the existing waiver until we get the new one approved. This would be contingent, at least what we would say, this would be contingent upon implementation of the new waiver dual system or dual waiver system, and so right now we're waiting.
Mr. Chairman, so just so I understand it, if we're successful on our dual waiver, they approve it, we do not do anything for the waiting list with additional funds and expanded budget, 103 will come off the waiting list. Is that what you said?
No, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. Is with the funding...
How many would come off the waiting list if we only were able to have the dual procedure that were submitted to the feds would be passed and accepted? How many would come off the waiting list with those funds?
172.
172 would come off just because of that.
172 would come off with the amount of money we're asking for here. With the new waiver in place, with the old waiver in place, with the same amount of money, we could only take 69 off the waiting list for the same amount of money, which is 103 less. So
okay, so the other question would be, with only the new waiver accepted, and that's all we're operating on, how many come off the waiting list?
172.
No additional money.
I can't answer that because we don't have the new system in place. You're talking about with a new system in place with no new money coming
in. That's correct. The new system's accepted. We're operating under that with a dual waivers, and how many would possibly come off the waiting?
We think somewhere, this is a range, somewhere between 100 to 300 people would come off the waiting list by 2018.
By 18. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Clarification on this money, if we don't get any acceptance. I think we're assuming that this is going to be used only for the new tier, for the new waiver. But if we don't get that, then is it going to be used for the old waiver? Let's say, hypothetically, we don't get approval. Money's there. Question is, what are we going to do with it? Do we wait till we get approval, or do we take some less people off the list? What's our plan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, the current waiver ends this next summer. It just goes away.
Right.
And so the state can just let it go away and not provide that service anymore, or two, it can ask for a new waiver, and that can be a continuation of the existing system as it is in place or something completely different. Right. We have submitted an application for the new waiver that will be put in place this summer. That would be the two grouping, the two waiver system. So something has to get approved by CMS, or else simply we won't have a waiver system. At least the feds won't contribute anymore to it. So all we have submitted to the federal government or CMS right now is the redesign.
Mr. Chairman, what I want to get down to, Director, is that there's been a lot of concern by providers and clients that the old waiver is going to completely go away and everything's going to be reshuffled, and the only thing you're going to have is the new waiver when it gets approved, when the old waiver expires. So my question is that the scenario that we're looking at next spring of 2015, or is it another scenario?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, what we anticipate being in place is a new waiver with two tiers or two separate waivers, and with the changes that we have been working on all throughout the course of this year. And the providers, guardians, the family members and such that have been involved, we've laid out what the new waiver system is going to be, and that we've posted it and made it available to people to see what it's going to be. But there's a big caveat on that, is until CMS approves it, we don't know if it's going to be exactly look like that, or there will be some other changes that CMS will mandate. We anticipate some changes will have to take place, but we don't see going away from the two-tier or the two system, because most states have a support waiver in place, and CMS has sent representatives to the state and has talked to groups saying that this is what is common in other states in the country. And so I anticipate us having this system in place and transitioning the people who are on the comprehensive waiver today over to comprehensive in the new waiver. We'll be making some changes, but they're not going to be just thrown into the support waiver. But the new ones coming on will be put into the support waiver unless their needs are so great to that justifies a comprehensive a waiver participation.
Okay, so I want to be real clear, Mr. Chairman, in 2015, you're going to apply for the old waiver in the same manner, comprehensive waiver, as it is today. You're hoping to have a new second-tier waiver, but the people that are on the comprehensive waiver as it is today will have to go through the case management process to determine whether or not they're in the comprehensive waiver or the new waiver. Is that's what going to occur at 2015?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, no.
Okay, good. All right.
In 2014,
yeah,
which will be the current waiver ends in June, we have to have a new waiver in place by that time.
Oh, okay.
So we are anticipating over the next few months working with CMS to get the all the details worked out where they approve it. We will then be transitioning those individuals who are in the current waiver, in the comprehensive waiver, over to the new system. But we will be evaluating each of them to determine their level of care needs and be making some adjustments. If we don't make any adjustments whatsoever, then there won't be a dollar saved because it will all be the same. And what the legislation said is the objective is to serve the people on the waiting list with the same amount of money. So what we have to do is to reduce funding somewhat for people on the existing comprehensive waiver in order to free up some money to take people off the waiting list. So each of those will be being evaluated, and a new level will be established for them. If it's and if it's a relatively small amount, we will transition them immediately. If it's a larger amount, we'll step it down over a couple years, so it's just not an immediate change. Now, in terms of the case management, that in terms of removing the conflict, moving towards a conflict-free case management, that will go into effect with the new waiver system. But there will be approximately a year to transition that system over to the new system. So that's kind of a general high-level discussion or description.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just have some concerns that as we're doing all of this next spring that we run into a problem like they did with the ACA and all our ducks aren't in a row. Providers aren't going to know what they're going to have. Clients aren't going to know what they have. We haven't got the case management system set up yet. It seems like we should at least get the case management system set up so as you do it, you know, I mean, I guess I'd like to see us run the old waiver system as far as taking people off into the new waiver system, kind of delay that part of it for a year and implement it as you're going through after you get your case management. I just feel like we're going to have some problems there. And do you share any of those concerns about not being able to do the job?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we've got a couple challenges. First of all, the legislature laid out very clear, very prescriptive what we should do. That was after a lot of discussion on all the things in Medicaid, and those were very clear. And so we are following what we feel is the intent of the legislature. Number two is the current waiver ends, just goes away this summer. So we have to submit something to CMS to put either to get a new waiver. Now, we could submit a continuation of the existing waiver, but it's still a new waiver. And that was not what we were directed to do. We were directed to do the two-tier system and the conflict-free case management, and we have a deadline that due to the fact that the current waiver ends. So that's why we're on the track we are. If the legislature says stop, then what we have to do is to quickly pull that waiver back, application to CMS back, and come up with a new waiver, which would be what I'm hearing is a continuation of the existing one, and submit that to CMS, and they'll extend that for multiple years. So that's the challenge that we're up against. It's just not in our hands to say, oh yeah, let's wait a year and let's not do this and not do that. We just don't have that that ability at this point in time with the current waiver ending and the legislation that was passed.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, I have a couple questions and follow-up. One, I believe I understood you to say the average number of years on the waiting list is something around 14 years. Was that wrong? What's the average amount of time of folks on the waiting list?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, the 14.3 years is the average time an adult is on the adult waiver.
Oh, okay, okay.
In terms of the waiting list, there is the waiting list changes every month. There are some people that drop off of it. They leave the state. They pass away. And some people then are brought on within the budget we have. But more often than not, more people apply on a monthly basis than drop off. So the waiting list continues to grow. We have some people who have been on the waiting list for over 5 years. And so for a variety of reasons, they are not on it. This exception request has been submitted to you is that anybody who's been on the waiting list for more than 18 months will be taken off. The money that we're asking for here would take off everybody who's been on 18 months or longer as of September 30 of this year. We are now in December, and that has changed since that time. It's a moving target because of people applying.
And Mr. Chairman and Director, did you do any analysis on other alternatives other than the 18 months, 24 months, 32? I mean, I'm assuming you've done some analysis of what those costs and the number of folks that would be brought off the waiting list on other scenarios?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, that is correct. And I can just give you, I've got it from taking everybody off immediately, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, and what the dollar amount would be and the number that would come off.
Do you have any analysis beyond the 24, if you add another 6 months or so to that?
That's the only, we just took it up to 24 months. It's okay. Easy enough to take it to, 30, 36, whatever time period. It's just, it's almost an arbitrary number. Is 18 months better or worse than in 12 months or 24 months? For the person who's on the waiting list, it's a big deal.
Mr. Chairman, I think if I could ask that you provide that to the committee just so we can see a range of options of costs, numbers, number of folks that are brought in off the waiting list, I think that would help us as we work through this issue, if you could do that.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, how far up do you want to go in terms of months?
For me, and I'm open to whatever, maybe add another 6 months, take it up to 30 months, do that, what you have already to 24 months, and then just add another six-month period to it.
Just for your edification, for 24 months, it's just shy of $8 million for immediate reduction. In other words, wiping off the waiting list as of September 30, that was $12.3 million. So you see that 24 months difference is $4 million difference.
And Mr. Chairman, just so I've got a better understanding, I understand that the plan now is those on the comprehensive waiver continue on the comprehensive waiver even after adoption of the two tier system. But does that is it envisioned that continues until those folks either pass away or leave the state, or is there some, do you envision some time frame on that where they would go through a renewed evaluation to see if they fit better in the more limited waiver?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, as part of the discussions we had, as we said, we would grandfather, in effect, those on the current comprehensive waiver. Now, with the understanding, though, that they are not guaranteed exactly the same dollar amount, but they're not going to just be thrown into the support waiver. They will be evaluated, and based on their needs, the funds would be appropriated on whatever it takes in that respect.
Mr. Chairman, but is that for forever, or is there a time limit that they're grandfathered and they remain on the...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubbs, we did not put a time limit. We just said, you're grandfathered. It was part of the attempt to work with that community and come up with a plan that hopefully would have some type of general acceptance. And, you know, some people said, that seems fair. Some people said, taking $1 away from my ward, my family member, or from this system is totally wrong, and you shouldn't be doing it. And so that was one of the changes, compromises, whatever you want to call it, that we made on it.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, this request, I assume, is based on an assumption that CMS will approve the two-tier system. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Monitz, yes. It is based on the new system because the old system won't be in place any longer.
And I assume that you're pretty sure that system is going to be approved. Is that correct or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have been working very closely with CMS throughout this whole process. We're not dreaming all this up by ourselves and then springing a surprise on CMS, because it's not the way to get something approved. So we have, every step along the way, we've been visiting with CMS, and we anticipate approval of this, maybe not exactly its current form, but generally, conceptually, we think it's going to be approved based on the input that we've received from CMS. And like I said earlier, is we've even had CMS officials in the state and speaking to community groups, talking about the need to transition to a support-type waiver system.
Okay. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Forslund and Mr. Peck, I think we're at that point in the budget where I would like you to try and refer to some of the cost savings or offsets that you had in the handout you gave us last year, that if we were to go with the Medicaid expansion group, what portion of these funds would be in those offsets that you showed us in this handout you gave us. So now, in the adult DD waiver, if we were to expand Medicaid, how much of that money would be offset?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, I don't think there'd be any savings, because the people who are eligible for the waiver today, it won't change as a result of the expansion, because a single adult today with a developmental disability who can qualify to be on Medicaid. So consequently, they are already one of the eligible groups. What the 17,600 that we've been referencing this morning are adults primarily, not totally, but adults primarily who do not meet the requirements of age, being age blind and disabled, being a pregnant woman, being basically those narrow categories that you have to fit in order to be eligible. So the offsets we were talking about, that this group is already eligible, and so there wouldn't be any savings that I see in that group.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, well, just going forward in your budget, when you get to one of those offsets, can you point that out to us?
Okay. The, Mr. Chairman, the significant one is dollar-wise. There's quite a few of them, but the most significant dollar-wise is in the mental health and substance abuse area.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for discussion is starts on page 88. That's the DD Children's Waiver. Again, the governor has approved the standard budget as submitted, and there is an exception request.
Again, Mr. Chairman, this is a request for funding to remove children on the waiting list who've been there more than 18 months. This would fund 115 of the 298 children who are on the list as of September 30th of this year. As a side note, the average time on a waiver for a child who comes onto the child waiver and then transitions into the adult waiver is 32.8 years. And the reductions of in terms of costs, if we take everybody off the waiver immediately, it would be $15.4 million. If we took everybody off over 24 months, it would be $4.1 million. And so that's the range from 100% to 24 months, or immediate to 24 months.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration starts on page 91, I believe. Yes, 91, and that is the acquired brain injury waiver. Again, the governor has approved the standard budget as submitted, and there is an exception request.
And Mr. Chairman, this would fund 51 of the 74 people who are on the waiting list as of September 30 of this year, and the average time on the waiver waiver here is 4.6 years, and the immediate reduction would cost $6.7 million. 24 months would cost $4.1 million, and 24 months would take 45 people off the waiver, and immediate would be the 74.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration is on page 84. That's the long-term care waiver. This waiver serves people as an alternative to nursing facilities, and there is no exception request, and the governor recommended the approval of the standard budget as submitted. Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration starts on page 97. That's the assisted living facility waiver. Again, no exception request, and the governor has approved the standard budget as submitted.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
As I look at this, looks like there are open slots available. This is a great program, I mean, particularly for those people that want to be in this kind of facility. Is that unusual to have open slots? Is it just is this something typically we see? Is there a reason for this? Or
I have Terry Green answer that.
It's one of the few programs in the state that we're not overusing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, the reason that there are open slots and people on the waiting list for this program is because they are in communities that do not have availability of beds, and they want to be in an assisted living facility in their community.
That is the reason for it. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. That is the reason for. Okay. Got it.
Mr. Chairman, that completes the Healthcare Financing Division. We're now moving on to the Public Health Division.
One down, three to go.
Yeah, we're moving right along.
Mr. Chairman, to save some time, we have consolidated a number of units in this division, primarily because of management issues, and also the budgets were relatively small. Didn't make a lot of sense to have a unit for such a small budget. So what I'm going to do when I go through a unit that was consolidated, I'll just mention that it was consolidated and try to speed things up a little bit.
So there, I think the thing we're always interested in are if positions were added. There's no new position, but some are transferred. Are there pay increases associated with that? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, the only additional position that we requested, two additional positions, and that was for the MMIS unit. One of those the governor approved. The other, the governor asked us to use a vacant position. There are no other requests for additional positions other than those that were transferred from DFS to the Department of Health.
So there's no transfers in any of these? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, while you're mentioning vacant positions, how many do you have out of your 1,200 employees are vacant? You can give me that later and tell me where they might be and, you know, kind of an idea on the dollar amount and the length, just to give me an update. Thank you.
No, Mr. Chairman, generally they run between 100 to 200. Most of the times those are at the facilities, and primarily the Life Resource Center and the State Hospital. And this morning I mentioned that about the Life Resource Center, I think we have 45 vacancies open there. I wouldn't be surprised it's in the same range, if not higher, at the State Hospital, but I'm not. Maybe it won't be that high, come to think of it. But between 100 to 200, and most of them are direct health care, and they're at the facilities. The biggest challenge, if when you take a look at the time that they're vacant, is generally those are hard to fill positions at, particularly at the state hospital, with very, the psychiatrist, psychologist, nurse practitioner type positions.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, just to further clarify your recent comment, on page 101, if you look at the bottom for the Public Health Division, you'll see that we started with 266 positions and we ended with 266 positions.
Perfect.
With the consolidation, we did move positions from one unit to another, but we didn't increase the number of positions in the division.
See, some of those are transfers, not turnovers.
Right.
And we're having that discussion with A&I. And then I think the other thing we're interested in is if you did transfer those, although these are in the same division, not like the ones you took from DFS, was there a position change that gave a salary increase?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the first unit is starts on page 102, and that is the Public Health Division Administration. There is no exception request, and the governor recommended approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Okay.
The next unit for consideration starts on page 106. That is the Public Health Preparedness Program. Again, no exception request. The governor approved the standard budget as submitted. Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration starts on page 110, and that's our Emergency Medical Services and Hospital Preparedness Program. The governor did approve the standard budget as submitted, and there is an exception request.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is to fund the trauma unit reviews that hospitals have to go through. Every 3 years, we try to do about a third of the state on a yearly basis. This was a part of a bill enacted in 1993 dealing with the comprehensive EMS and trauma system. Department reviews, as I mentioned, about a third of hospitals for trauma capability on a yearly basis. The legislature approved one-time funding for this during 2013-14. We're simply asking for a continuation of that for 15-16. I'm not sure why it is a one-time authorization, and we certainly wouldn't object to having it part of our standard budget.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, moving on.
Mr. Chairman, on page 115, is the Poison Center, that unit was consolidated into the previous unit, the Emergency Medical Services.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit starts on page 117, and that's the Rural and Frontier Health. No exception request for this unit, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. And Mr. Chairman, the next five units have been consolidated into Unit 510. Again, as I talked to you about, they're smaller programs and felt like it would be a better use of paper and management to have them all under the Rural and Frontier Health unit. So those are units 511 on page 121. That's the Community Services Program, 100% federal funds. Unit 513 on page 124, which is the Healthcare Provider Loan Repayment Program.
Representative Meyer?
The Tobacco Settlement Funds that you're using on that Healthcare Provider Loan Repayment, when those are repaid, do they go back into the tobacco settlement proceeds in some way or another, or accounts?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Meyer, I think according to AG rules, if we provide funding to a provider, healthcare provider, to repay their loan, to help repay their loan, and they don't fulfill their commitment, then I think the way the AG rules work, the AG collects those funds and they actually go back into the general fund.
Ah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The next unit on page 126 is renal dialysis, and again, that was consolidated into Unit 510. The next unit is on page 128. That's our organ donation unit. And that's about $9,500 a biennium. We consolidated that into rural health. And the last unit in this area is our telehealth unit, Unit 516 on page 130, again consolidated into rural and frontier health.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Coach.
Don, do we have in our agency handouts a report on the tobacco fund? How much is in it, how much went in, how much went out, where it went, and all that? Has that been submitted to us already?
Mr. Chairman, we have the total balance. We do have another report that I could provide you that shows it's done on a monthly basis by the Treasurer's Office that reviews all of the distributions from that fund and inflows to it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just get that to us in terms of how much is left, how much we spend every year. And as I remember, Tom, on that one, there's a – the money stops coming in maybe 2018 or 19, and then there's going to be a lot of that is utilized to really supplement your funding, and when that goes away, there's going to be a void there of funding. Is my memory correct, or am I thinking of something else?
You know.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Co-Chair, there has been some progress, and the AG's office handles the tobacco settlement. They could probably give you a better synopsis than I can. But there was a recent resettlement among some of the manufacturers that we participated in. We actually got some additional lump sum distributions through that process, and those are in the income account today, and some of those have not been appropriated. And there is the funds will wind down over a period of time, and there is I've raised some concern that at some point in time, the annual distributions that we get from that settlement will not fund our current appropriations from that account.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, that's what I was getting at. There's a large amount of capital there that we get the interest off of, but there's also an ongoing revenue stream that continues to tick down, and it seems to me like 3 or 4 or 5 years out, it goes away completely. And that's a pretty big number. So, Don, when we get that, let's see what that is, and just to have the information for us. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration is Unit 132. That was our Community and Public Health Administration Unit. We consolidate all the administration into different programs, so we wouldn't have three administration accounts in one division. Keep in mind that a couple years ago, there were 5 different divisions that make up the public health today. So we are eliminating all the admin accounts and putting them in different units. The next unit for consideration is Unit 135. That's our oral health program. No exception request. The governor approved the standard budget as submitted. Next unit is on page 139. That's our immunization unit. Again, the governor approved the standard budget as submitted, and there is an exception request.
Mr. Chairman, the request is for approximately $2.7 million for this. It's based on the CREST is to provide required and recommended vaccines to children that do not qualify for the Federal Vaccine for Children program per the Wyoming Immunization Act. Based on current vaccine administration trends and the projected costs of children's vaccines, expected that the state vaccine costs for the next biennium will be $8,286,000. Without the exception request, the department will likely be dropping the pneumococcal vaccine as a result of insufficient funding. The problem is that this costs the provider $120.95 per dose. And so because if we don't provide it to make it available, then the providers have to buy that themselves and stock it. And then if they don't sell it, in effect, then they have to eat that cost. Because at the $120.95 rate, it's so high, we anticipate that there will be a group of providers saying, I just can't afford to eat that cost, and they will drop it. So it will be an issue of access. And as I mentioned this morning, is public health immunization is probably one of the most significant public health initiatives that have ever been developed. And it is something that the state has been supportive of it over a number of years. If we start to scale back our support, we'll end up with, we think, more issues related to those people who have not gotten the appropriate vaccines. And we think that is a step backwards for the state and the state's public health, and we'd recommend approval of this vaccination and having it in our budget as part of the standard budget, instead of us having to come back every year or 2 years and asking for it once again.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, Director Forslin, just again trying to get a little bit of a grip around the ACA's potential impacts to your budget. In focusing primarily on the pediatric vaccines, given the influx of children onto the Medicaid program, and I thought now there was a requirement that there had to be insurance coverage for vaccinations. It seems like there would be more, and through other programs, kids would be eligible to have these costs covered, but yet we still see this program growing. And just wondering if you could address that a little bit. And secondarily, the request to fold this into your standard budget, I'm wondering why it isn't a good idea, given the sort of changing landscape, to look at this every biennium to see if it still makes sense given the coverage available.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson. The whole issue of the ACA is certainly percolating nationwide as well as throughout the state. And the issue is we have 83,000 people without health insurance within the state today. And a portion of those people would be eligible for Medicaid coverage if there was expansion, of which we've said no to. A portion of those will be between 100% and 400%, and they will get subsidies based on their income level, and those people above 400% will still be required to have private insurance and won't get the subsidy. The question that certainly people have been raising is the penalty or the fine or the tax, whatever you want to call it, is relatively small initially. It ratchets up. Two is there's a lot of people who are saying, you know, they don't want to be told that they have to get insurance and they're not about to get insurance. And so you have a certain amount of resistance of people who, at this point in time, based on what we're hearing, are not going to comply with the ACA. Those people who are at the lower income levels will have access to the immunization, the vaccines, because we cover those people based on those children, based on parents' income, low income. It's those people that are above those income levels that we're most concerned about, is that if their parents do not have insurance for whatever reason, will they simply then not get the vaccine? Or two is if they do have the vaccine, want to get the vaccine or get the immunization, but the provider elects not to carry it, will they make the effort to go to a different provider or leave town and find it somewhere else? Or will they just simply say, too much of a bother, we won't do it? Additionally, with the state being able to purchase this and then make it available to physicians, it's made available and there's less cost than if a physician has to buy it directly themselves from a drug manufacturer. So there's a variety of reasons for it. I'll ask Dr. Brown if she wants to add anything to what I said.
Hi, Dr. Wendy Braun, State Health Officer and Senior Administrator of the Public Health Division. The Director Forslund has touched upon this. The really important issue here is access. A child can have insurance, but if the local provider isn't carrying the vaccine and can't give the vaccinations, then it doesn't matter if a child has insurance. The fact is that vaccines cost physicians money. They lose money providing vaccinations to children. A study in the Journal of Pediatrics that looked at influenza vaccine, which is recommended for all children, estimated what it would cost if, in fact, all children were vaccinated and providers were reimbursed at the average VFC provider, which is the federal program. They get vaccines for free. If providers were reimbursed at the national average for the VFC program, given the total cost of the vaccine, so that would include staff costs, overhead, so forth, the loss to the pediatricians across the country in 1 year, if just a third of the children got their influenza vaccination, would be $98 million. So if we are not able to provide vaccines to our pediatricians to our and our family docs through the YVIT program, which is the state-funded immunization program. We will see providers dropping some of those vaccines. In fact, in 2011, when we dropped four vaccines from the state formulary because the program was underfunded, the number of doses that were ordered by our physicians dropped in half. Another issue that has to do with access is that through the state program, because we are supplying the vaccine, we have the ability to redistribute it as needed. For private providers, as the director said, if they overestimate and buy too much vaccine and are not able to use it, then they eat those costs, which is very expensive. And an example of whereas if we are providing it, we can distribute it. And a good example of that is influenza last year. We had shortages around the state. There was not a national shortage, but that is a vaccine that is currently provided privately and through the VFC program, not through the state-funded program. And so we did have a lot of people who wanted to go to their local provider and get influenza vaccine, and it was not available.
Well, Mr. Chairman, okay. Mr. Coach, you know, I appreciate your arguments, and they all made sense to me until you, instead you started saying that we're gonna help cover the doctors that can't make up their mind how much they should have. You know, in the world I live in, that's my decision, and I have to take that responsibility. If I buy too much, or if I have a store and I have a certain amount of clothes or whatever, I buy too much, it's out of season, I eat that. So I don't just necessarily agree with that argument. But the question I would have is if that happens and you redistribute it to these docs and they provide that service, their nurses usually give the shot, do they charge for it? Or do they just pro bono the physical person giving them the shot? And since the state gives them the vaccine, they take that off of their bill.
They, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, providers are allowed to charge an administration fee for vaccine that is provided free of charge through the VFC program, the Vaccines for Children, the federal program, or the YVIP, the state-funded program. That fee is about $22. So when you look at a vaccination like pneumococcus, the one we're considering dropping without the additional funding, that administration fee doesn't begin to cover the cost of that vaccine.
And, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, with your analogy or your comparison there, when you said that in your business, if you make a decision and you overbuy and have too much in your inventory, you eat it. And that is true, but the consequences are only to you and to your business. The case in this situation is if physicians say, okay, it's too much of a cost, I'm not going to a risk, I'm not going to carry it, and then you have children who end up being exposed to others who have not been vaccinated, who have ill, it has an impact beyond just that physician's business. It impacts the health of children within that area or that community.
And, Mr. Chairman, can they not go to the public health nurse and get this in vaccination as well? They don't have to go to a doctor, right, or they do?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, the public health nursing offices do provide vaccinations.
Right.
That vaccine is provided through the state-funded program.
So then, Mr. Chairman, you could just have, you know, that's where I go. That's where a lot of people go, to the public health nurse. They don't even get involved with the doc on it. It's just so much simpler. But what you're saying, you think you need to have both because a lot of people will not go to the public nurse. Therefore, they will not get the vaccination. So that's what your argument is?
No, what we'll say is that we won't have that vaccination available at the office for those people.
But it's available at the public nurse for them to give to them. They have it, right?
But not for the general public, in effect.
Well, wait a minute. The question is, can someone go to a public health nurse in a county like we have in Fremont County and get a vaccination? That's the first question.
The answer to that is yes.
Okay, so then if you have this out there and it's available, it'll always be available to the public health nurse, and they can get it there without even having to go to a physician, correct?
But you're assuming that we have the money to purchase the vaccine, so it will be available to administer. And what we're, if we don't receive the funding, then we won't be able to purchase that vaccine.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's for both. It's just not for the docs. It's for the public health nurses as well, then, is what you're saying.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, yes, that is
okay.
That is true. In fact, three-quarters of our providers are private providers. So the public health nurses give the minority of the vaccinations
okay,
in
so,
the state.
So it is so clear, and I think there was some confusion. There has been. You buy the vaccine for all the providers, whether a public health nurse, private doctor, whoever. And if you don't have the money, you're not buying the vaccine for anybody.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The less money we have, the less vaccines we have. And what I'm telling you that if we don't get this appropriation, then it looks like at this point we will be dropping the pneumococcal vaccine.
And the kid won't be able to get that at public health or his pediatrician.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if the physician says, okay, I'm going to buy it, that vaccine directly from a pharmaceutical he might be able to get the vaccine, might not. Just depends
right.
on...
Different price. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wallace had it. Okay. Representative Nicholas.
I've got a few questions. What were the four vaccines that were dropped as a result of having insufficient funding?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, it was influenza, hepatitis A, meningococcal vaccine, and HPV, human papillomavirus.
And those were selected because of their cost or because of the less need of the public to receive them or not a demand for them or a mental health or a health need?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, I was not involved in that decision. It predated my tenure at the Department of Health. However, I believe it had to do with the required school vaccines, and those vaccines are not required for school entry, and we wanted to preserve the ability to provide all of the vaccines that are required for school, so that wouldn't be a barrier.
And, Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the influenza shot you can get at the local drugstore, and you can stop by Sam's Club, and they administer the influenza things for $16 or $22. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, if you are an adult, that is correct.
So they can't administer it to anyone unless their parent is there, or they can't administer it to anyone under 18?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, at the current time, pharmacists cannot immunize children. That will change due to legislation last session. And pharmacists will be able to vaccinate children down to age 13. That is not in place yet. And that's only for flu. Mm-hmm.
And, Mr. Chairman, with regards to the pneumococcus, what is that for and how prevalent or what's the need for it in terms of ongoing usage? How many inoculations has the state bought and used over the last couple of years or something?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, in terms of the what it causes invasive pneumococcal disease, the most common presentation of that is pneumonia. Prior to the vaccine being created, it was the number one killer of infants. Prior to the vaccine, there were about 65,000 cases annually and 6,000 deaths. Since then, there has been a 75% reduction.
I don't believe that answered the question, Mr. Chairman. So how many vaccines did the state of Wyoming give in the last year or 2 years? And why? I mean, is that selected just because of the cost or because it's not administered very often? I'd just like to know why that one, what's the logic behind it or and the risk exposed.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, I do not have the number specifically for pneumococcus. I can tell you vaccines in total. We have given over in fiscal year 13, we immunized 106,000 children, and that was about 165,000 vaccine doses in total. But that is not the the pneumococcal disease specifically. In terms of the impact of that, our uptake of the with vaccines in general, in order to achieve herd immunity, which means that people who are not vaccinated are protected because the bulk of people are vaccinated. Generally, herd immunity, you need about 75% vaccination. For some vaccines, it is higher. For a pneumococcal vaccine, our vaccination rate is 79% for the complete four-shot series. So it will not take very long for us to get below the threshold of herd immunity for that disease. So there are significant public health implications. And yes, thank you, sir. And the reason we're dropping it is because it costs $1.68 million. It's an expensive vaccine. We only have two choices. There are two vaccines left on the formulary that are not required for school, and those are pneumococcus and rotavirus. Rotavirus costs a tenth of what a pneumococcal vaccine does. So cutting rotavirus isn't going to make up the deficit. So my only option is to cut pneumococcus in order to maintain the other vaccine administration.
So, Mr. Chairman, the cut that you, if we don't fund it, what we're really doing is cutting the $1.6 million plus rotavirus. Is that a fair representation in terms of how much you're adding per biennium?
Chairman Harshman, Representative Nicholas, we will maintain rotavirus, and we will cut pneumococcal vaccine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I want some more of this.
I've fully been vaccinated on this issue.
It's a real shot in the arm this time of the afternoon. Yeah, anyway,
thank you. We all need it.
Can you just tell me, just explain to me the difference between the YVIP and the VFC programs and the eligibility requirements for the two, differentiate between?
Again, Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to Dr. Braun.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the VFC, the Vaccines for Children program, is the national federal vaccine program. Eligibility requirements for that program are to be Medicaid eligible or Native American Pacific Islander. The YVIP program, which is the state program, is for all other children in Wyoming per the statute. That was put in place in 2006 that said that the department will vaccinate all children in Wyoming who are not eligible for the VFC program. The department purchases the vaccine for both the YVIP and VFC programs through the CDC, and therefore we get a significant discount on the cost of the vaccine compared to what private providers pay. And then our providers, who typically do all three, participate in VFC, participate in YVIP, and give private stock, then keep those stocks separate and keep track of who is eligible for what program.
Mr. Chairman? So the next question I'd have then is, I mean, we have a substantial number of kids that are covered under SCHIP and would have insurance coverage. Does that insurance coverage pay for vaccines, and do we recover any money from the insurances that we have for under SCHIP for vaccines that are given to children under, I guess it would be under the YVIP, because the other ones would be Medicaid?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we cannot ask the physicians to pay us back for the vaccine that we give them, because the CDC considers that reselling of vaccine, and that would give a competitive advantage, over the private sector, because vaccines are so much more expensive from private manufacturers. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to a question that Representative Nicholas had and make sure that it was clear that Dr. Braun was talking about the dollar amount. That was on a yearly basis, not a biennium basis.
Thank you. So on a biennial basis, that would be, it's $1.6 million, so it would be $3.2 million.
Yes.
Right.
And so we need that amount to, with the current budget, to be able to afford 2 years of this.
Mr. Chairman, that is the last unit in this division that has an exception request. So the next unit for consideration is Unit 144, which is the Maternal and Child Services Program. Again, no exception request. The governor recommended approval of the standard budget. The next unit for consideration is starts on page 148. That is the Nurse Home Visitation Program. Again, no exception request. The governor recommended approval of the standard budget as submitted. The next unit for consideration starts on page 151. That is the Women's Infants Children Program, commonly referred to as WIC. Again, there is no exception request, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. The next unit for consideration is on page 155. That's the Public Health Nursing Unit, our program, and again, no exception request. The governor recommended approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Mr. Chairman, question for Tom. We had some issues last year with some funding positions in your department and had to deal with the public health, and Senator Scott was involved in that somewhat, and we were doing some swapping. Has that all worked out and all okay, or is it one of those deals that it's not okay but it's over?
Mr. Co-Chairman, put it this way, it continues to be an issue. Mm-hmm. You eliminated one position within the public health nursing in this last session. We are working with the county commissioners to come up with some different models. So it's not one size fits all for across the state. So if Natrona County or Fremont County wants to handle it differently than Laramie County, then we would have a couple different options. Currently, there are three counties that do not receive any support through public health nursing. That's Sweetwater, Natrona, and Campbell. Sweetwater and Natrona want to come back into the system, but they would like to have move towards a performance contract where essentially the state hires them and they provide all the staffing and provide the services and produce the outcomes. And so that's not permitted currently. Others want some other changes, so what we've come up with is some different models, and we're still working with the county commissioners. Some of the commissioners love what it is and don't want any changes. Some would like to see some changes. And so consequently, we are finalizing that. We will be reporting our kind of progress to the Joint Labor Committee next month. But ultimately, even if it is approved, there is no money in this budget for those three counties that I mentioned. So for us to, even if we had different options, we would need an extra appropriation to bring on those three counties.
Thank you.
Is it, Director Forson, shows on 158 then, but you're down two positions from your base budget to your standard. I thought you mentioned one nurse. I can't remember either that deal. Is there down two? Is that correct, or did you transfer one?
Do you remember?
Page 158.
I don't remember which one it actually was.
Mr. Chairman,
in the right spot.
Yeah. I was thinking it was one position that we had eliminated. It this shows two. I see that. Let us look into it. initially, I know the request was to reduce it by two, but I think one of the committees reinstated one of them. But we'll double check.
Okay, thank you. Brett?
Mr. Chairman, our information reflects that there are two positions that moved out of this unit, one to unit 0523 and one to unit 0101.
I know we took a slot, so it must have been one of the... let us get that, and we'll send give you an update.
What were those units they went to, Brett, again? 0523 and...
Mr. Chairman, 0523 and 0101.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
I believe additionally the reduction that Mr. Forslund is referring to actually occurred in the base itself, so you would see a different in the base
you
count.
Wouldn't even see it. We wouldn't see it then even. Yeah. Okay, very good.
Mr. Chairman, I should note we're over halfway through our budget now.
Good, we're making great time. I was hoping we'd get done by midnight. Looks like we're going to make it.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration is on page 159. This is the administration I referred to before for a previous division. That budget was transferred to unit 539. Mr. Chairman, next unit for consideration starts on page 162. That is the cancer screening program. Again, no exception request. The governor recommended approval of the standard budget as submitted. Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration is on page 162.
Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair.
This is one that really works. Have we got updated information as to the benefits of it? I know the WCCCC is working on it. If you had some stuff that just showed the statistics, please distribute it to us because it really does work and it's a good program.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration starts on page 166. That's the public health laboratory. No exception request. The governor recommended approval of the standard budget as submitted. Mr. Chairman, the next unit is on page 170. This is the cancer program state, which is the program that the co-chair was speaking about. We've actually combined that with the other cancer screening program, so we have them all in one place. Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Co-Chairman. You asked for some information on the early detection screening statistics. Do you want me to tell you, or do you want us to provide it?
Just send us the numbers, please. That way I want to get out of here before midnight.
Okay.
Well, unless you want to talk about something that's really positive. Not that everything else hasn't been positive today. It has.
All this stuff is positive, Mr. Chair, but...
that's supposed to be funny. It's not very funny.
But we have some good outcome data on this, so we'll make it available.
Just share it with you, please.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, next unit for consideration starts on page 173, the communicable disease unit. Again, no exception request, and the governor approved the standard budget as submitted. The next unit for consideration is 177. This is the STD prevention program. We consolidated this unit into the communicable disease unit that we just spoke about. Next unit for consideration is on page 180. This is the environmental and occupational health unit. No exception request. The governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. Next unit is listed on page 184. That's the TB control and elimination unit. Again, that unit was transferred to the communicable disease unit. Next unit is on page 187, and that is the chronic disease epidemiology and surveillance program. Again, no exception request. The governor recommended approval of the standard budget as submitted.
You know, I just this is one of those tobacco settlement funds. And we'll get some more information, I guess, but whether this is kind of interest earnings off the corpus or if we're spending down one-time funds on that, I think co-chairman talked about that.
Mr. Chairman?
I want to check. Senator Perkins.
Yeah, on that, is do we coordinate with the epidemiologist in workforce services as far as the overall epidemiology of our risk behaviors and things like that, or is this a separate program?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, we do work in cooperation with the epidemiologists that you're talking about. Some of it is, there's some overlap, some there is not, but Dr. Brown and some of her staff have worked with him. I don't know if that answers.
Mr. Chairman, all I'm wondering is, it's one of those things that we want the right hand and what the left hand's doing, because ultimately if we're having risk behaviors or other things like that we can make a difference in identifying and trying to eliminate, that's good for everybody. So,
hey, Mr. Chairman, moving on, next unit for consideration starts on page 191. That is the chronic disease prevention unit. Again, no exception request. The governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Question I got on that is that the standard budget's 10 positions over the base budget. You tell me what was going on there?
Mr. Chairman, as I stated earlier, we moved the staffing that was in the old Preventive Health and Safety Division, which was Unit 531, I believe. We moved that into this unit.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, so we can track this stuff, why didn't that come as an exception request when you did these moves? And could we have a one page about all these consolidations? Because I can't track it by exception request because it doesn't show up when you do the consolidation. It would seem that those 10 people would have came in with an exception request and a footnote saying why. So if we could get a one page about how that's going on, Brent's over there. I guess maybe he's already got it in some spot that we haven't seen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, all of this information by specific position number is all reflected in the Chapter 17 report. So those movements that have occurred through the Net to Zero project are detailed out within that report.
Okay, thank you. Okay, continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration starts on page 195. This is the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Unit. Again, no exception request, and the governor approved the standard budget as submitted.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, the last unit in public health starts on page 199. This is the Substance Abuse and Suicide Prevention Unit. Just a note, you will notice that there is no base budget. These are prevention activities that were formerly housed in the Behavioral Health Division, and through the reorganization of the department, we moved all prevention activities to the Public Health Division.
Okay.
Again, the no exception request, the governor did approve the standard budget as submitted. We're now at Behavioral Health.
You want to take about a five-minute stretch, Mr. Chairman?
Okay, let's take a five-minute stretch. I guess it is 3 o'clock. How time flies when you're talking.
I was trying to give a hint. That was a good time for a break.
I got that. Okay, let's get started again. I think we're on, I'm not sure, I think we're on page 200.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we that starts the behavioral health division. Actually, no, we're on page 203. And that is the summary of the behavioral health division.
Okay.
You will notice on the employee count on page 204 that the base budget was 844. The governor's recommendation is 828, a reduction of 16 positions. I believe most of those positions were at the facilities that were eliminated in the budget cut process. So, Mr. Chairman, the first unit is on page 205. That's Behavioral Health Administration. No exception request. The governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Mr. Chairman. Sorry, it's me.
Oh, Representative Stubbs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My hearing's going. I can't tell where it's coming from.
One of the numbers that just leaped out on this one to me, we've got an out-of-state travel number of 334, or maybe that's in-state travel, 334,000, and you've only got, you know, three personnel in there. I'm just wondering where that, how that squares up.
Actually, both those in and out-of-state
yeah.
are up significantly. About tenfold, eightfold on the other.
Mr. Chairman, I think part of that was part of the net to zero process. I think, and we will look into that and give you a breakout of how that, where that money was, where it is now, and what it's used for.
That's a lot.
Wow. I make a lot of trips to Arizona during
yeah,
the year,
I'll see
Mr.
You.
Chairman.
Per day rate, that's a lot of money every day. Wow.
Mr. Chairman, I can guarantee you that's not going to be used by those three people. For we will just not need to figure out what that is and get back to you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I will note when we go to the next unit that actually when we broke out the old unit 2502, we tried to put in that unit just the services that were provided, and we did move the admin cost to 2501 through the net to zero process. If you look at page 210, I'll skip over just a little bit since we're on that subject, you'll see that the out-of-state or the in-state travel in this unit went from 317,000 down to 13,000. So it was a net to zero process, but we still probably need to explain to you what that travel is used for.
Even that, though, with the number of employees, that's a lot of...
Something's wrong there.
Yeah, it just doesn't look right. So. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think the budget office might have done something there. Where's Brett when we
need since he's not here...
Yeah, where's Brett when you need him, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Conveniently absent.
I think that had to do with ETS, I think, so yeah. They asked us to cover their travel. Mr. Chairman, the next unit is on page 208, and this is now called Recovery Supports. It used to be called Mental Health and Substance Abuse. What we did was we moved all of the specific services to new units, and that would be Mental Health Outpatient, Mental Health Inpatient, Substance Abuse Outpatient, and Substance Abuse Inpatient. And you'll see those in units 2506, 2507, 2508, and 2509. And this is one of the areas where we had those offsets that Representative Expo's talk about, so the director is going to speak a little bit to that.
And, Mr. Chairman, just to talk a little bit about the reorganization issues that that Bob was talking about, it's public health. We had a whole lot of, in effect, cost centers or programs that were relatively small. You got over to mental health and substance abuse, and you had one huge number in one center, and we said you can't break it apart. And so what we wanted to do was to bring consolidate some of those smaller public health programs together, but in behavioral health, break it apart a little bit more so we have an understanding of exactly how that money is being spent. With that said, then what was Representative Esquivel was talking earlier about was the offsets that we had presented to you a year ago in terms of Medicaid expansion, and there we presented a listing of 14 of these programs that could be reduced to and then diverted over. This particular area was the largest in terms of mental health and substance abuse. We identified $198,500,000 in funds that could be diverted or used to transfer over to the Medicaid. And of that, $121 million of it came from the mental health and substance abuse area.
Mr. Chairman,
let's go.
And just, I haven't really gone through these budgets sitting on the JAC before, and I want to be sure, is this the program that was initiated like mid 2000, three or four, that before had been zero and has now grown to like $100, $120 million? Is this that mental health and substance abuse program?
Together, if you put those together, yes. This is an area that a select committee was put together, and they put to a series of additions, and this budget went up significantly. I think we presented that to the JAC the last time we were here talking about the growth and all the different programs. This one experienced significant growth, is now the second largest in effect program within the Department of Health after Medicaid.
Mr. Chairman, have you looked at, have you done some analysis on how to reduce this or get it under more control, cut things out of it? Have you looked at that at all, or is it just kind of a thing that's ongoing and growing?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, this is I'll identify or answer that in a couple ways. One is it's an area that we thought if Medicaid was expanded that we could cut back significantly because providers would be able to bill private insurance and or Medicaid for those costs, and then we could take the money that goes in block grants, a portion of, not all of it, but a portion of it, and move it over. And so that was originally part of our thinking. Now, with the decision not to expand, becomes more of a challenge because you have a situation where those people at 100% and below won't be eligible for Medicaid, won't have private insurance. If they need mental health services, they can still go to the mental health facilities, but those facilities will need the block grant, at least to support them. However, those people at 100% and above will be in a position to have insurance, and then if they have the insurance, the community mental health organizations will be able to bill those insurance. If we continue to take a look at continuing the block grants with no changes, anybody who walks in the door with insurance can potentially then be billed for services through insurance, plus also they'll be able to use the block grant. So it's on our radar. We're taking a look at. We're visiting with the community mental health organization, but the challenge we have is those people with no insurance at all, where will they be able to get mental health services? It has to be through these organizations, and those organizations have to be supported with some type of state support to handle those most vulnerable individuals.
Mr. Chairman, this is one that's got a huge amount of tobacco settlement funds. So what happens to this program when that goes to zero? What? How is that? Is it just allocated in the big pot of the $100 million we spend, or is it a specific thing they use it specifically for?
Well, this is the situation that where we're at right now is the dollar amount was all just in one big pot, and it was hard to segregate those amounts. So we've set this budget up now in four different areas, and we will hopefully be able to track that better and be able to answer some of those questions that you that you and others have raised about how that money is being spent. But you know, you have inpatient, you have outpatient services, you have the wraparound services. There's a whole variety of services. And we're trying to get some handle on that. Also, trying to get a handle on the outcomes. We're putting a lot of money in it on a yearly basis. What outcomes are we getting in or a return on investment for the state?
So there will be a time, Mr. Chairman, where you can specifically talk about tobacco settlement, one of these four subdivisions you're discussing, and we'll get into that then. Is that how that will work? What I'm trying to get at, Chairman, is those tobacco settlement funds are going away. I want to know where they're being spent in this program and what the impact would be when they're gone.
I'll let Mr. Peck talk about a little bit about that.
Mr. Chairman, just to give you a precursor on that, most of the tobacco settlement funds that were allocated to the Department of Health were in the Behavioral Health Unit. There are two primary programs that received the majority of those funds, and that was the Tobacco Cessation Program and Prevention Program. Recall, I mentioned that program was moved to the Preventive Services and Public Health, so we've already made it past those funds. Most of the remaining funds are actually in the substance abuse treatment programs, and we'll get to those, and I can show you where those are.
Let me make it simple, Mr. Yeah. Chairman. How much money do we spend in Department of Health on these ads we're seeing all over the state for prevention and all these different things? How much money is it? Get that for me, if you would, please. You don't have to look it up now. If you'd provide that, I'd appreciate it. And then the other thing is, where does it come from? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to point out that $12.5 million figure, that represents probably about half of it, the tobacco trust money that's in the Department of Health. But there's a significant amount, almost about that much, about $11.5 million in our Department of Corrections of tobacco trust money that we're allocating out. And the Attorney General's office, they take up a chunk of that as well.
You know, I know we've had a summary on these, Don, probably last year. Every year we get it. We're probably going to need to take a minute and look at those. So put that on the list and which ones we're spending trust and then the ones that are coming in.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, so for Unit 2502, that's now called Recovery Supports. This is the piece of the mental health and substance abuse that doesn't deal in direct services. So everything else, the wraparound services we provide to clients who are in treatment, is now left in this unit. And again, there is no exception request, and the governor did approve the standard budget as submitted. Okay, the next unit for consideration starts on page 213. This is our court-supervised treatment. And this is another program that is, again, funded with tobacco funds. Partially tobacco funds, about $4.8 million in tobacco funds, so almost over half of the funding. Again, there is no exception request, and the governor approved the standard budget as submitted. Next unit is on page 217. This is the Tobacco Prevention, Control, and Cessation Unit that I mentioned was transferred into Unit 550 in the Public Health Division. And again, there was about $7.5 million in tobacco funds in that program. The next unit starts on page 220. This is the Wyoming State Hospital. The governor did approve the standard budget as submitted, and there are exception requests.
Mr. Chairman, these are a couple of standard ones. One is a request for $415,000 for replacement of state hospital equipment, and this has come from the state land fund source, not from the general fund. This replaces equipment in like housekeeping equipment, food service, those type of currently
what,
the balance.
What page is that one on, that exception request?
Page 222, 223.
Skipped over it then. Okay. Okay, thank you, Gavin.
Last amount I had there was a little over $2.4 million in that fund at that point in time. The next one is hospital maintenance. There was $400,000 for there, and that is to do facility maintenance. That does not qualify for A&I major maintenance. And again, that money would come from the state land fund that I mentioned before. Additionally, in here now is the first of three items that you see how the governor allocated the money for the supporting or beginning the work on the state master facilities plan. And there was $15 million from the strategic investment and project account to address this issue. And again, this is the one that I was talking about, is if we can have a placeholder and have this discussion going forward and on what we should do with the facilities, I think that would be a good and prudent use of funds.
Mr. Chairman?
As co-chair.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chairman. You said this is not under the maintenance like that A&I has. Is this, why is it so unique, the $400,000? Why does it have to be done this way?
It's for smaller items that are too small to be qualified under that fund.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is an ongoing. This is consistent with what happens in the past for the. So it could happen at the WLRC. It could happen in Basin. I see someone in the back nodding their head.
Yes.
So that's where does it tip over? So it becomes so small that you don't do it with A&I. Is it $500,000 or square footage? How is it determined?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure we've ever been given a guideline as to what should be included, but I would venture to guess that it's probably any individual request being around $25,000.
Okay.
Most of them are much larger than that.
Did you skip one back on 221, or did I? Was I working on something else?
Disappeared. Let me disappeared.
Yeah, I'll let Bob talk about
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chairman, I apparently failed to give the director notes where we put it in the wrong place. On page 221, there is an exception request to fund the Title 25 emergency detention costs related to the state hospital. These are currently we have about $6 million in our budget to cover these costs. They've averaged over the last biennium about $10 million. We are attempting to make improvements in that process to make more beds available so the individuals who are titled to the state hospital do not stay in the community. They get to the hospital where they need to be. So we did make a request for an additional $2 million. The governor did recommend that we deny the request but allowed us to use 100 series vacancy savings to cover these additional costs.
Mr. Chairman, this is one of those situations where the hospital is required to pick up a cost that is incurred at the local levels and through the Title 25 process, and ultimately then we get billed and the state hospital has to pay the bill to some of these providers. It's a situation where we haven't had the full appropriation from, you know, for this, so each time we have to come in and ask for additional funding. Usually it gets turned down and we're told just to absorb it through vacant positions. So then we say, okay, guess we need to keep vacant positions because we keep getting assigned to pay for things that we don't have budget for, and so that means that we need to keep those vacant positions to pay for some of these unknown costs that are coming to us. And again, as Mr. Peck said, it's been running $8-10 million a biennium, and that's a significant dollar amount. And we've gotten some funding, but we haven't gotten the full funding for as much that has that we've incurred.
Senator Meyer,
you know. Director, I'd just soon put it all on top of the table myself. I guess I don't know how the committee feels, but, you know, we've got 45 positions that or more or less that you said was at the Lander facility, if I recall what you said earlier, and you're thinking that you probably should be taking positions off of there. We're just carrying the positions. They're acting like a slush fund box. You know, it seems like what we need to do is have an accounting, get everything on top of the table. Vacant positions that are held over for that purpose probably should be eliminated. So, you know, at some time, Mr. Chairman, I guess the committee should make up their mind whether we put all of the budget on top of the table or whether they keep it underneath.
Duly noted. All right. I'm sure somebody will have an amendment at markup.
Mr. Chairman, also, there is a footnote on page 224. This is a standard footnote that's been our budget for many years, and all it does is allows any revenue that is collected at the state hospital to use to help pay for the involuntary hospitalizations or the Title 25 costs. It also pays for health and safety issues at the facility. So we're just asking that we retain that footnote.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Co-Chair.
Is there some legislation proposed under Title 25? I know that it's a timing issue when they're a threat. They have to come in, the police arrest them, then they have to so many hours to get them out of the local jail, to get them to the state hospital, and the counties don't want to pay for it. And is there some legislation to try to fine-tune that out there?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, Judiciary Committee, I believe, is moving forward with a bill this upcoming session.
Mr. Chairman, what is the effect that it would have on your budget? Is it that far along to see what it looks like, or is it still very early?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, I would not feel comfortable saying that's going to save us this much money at this point in time. We hope it will, but don't know.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, you'll see that with a physical note. They'll come to you possibly, and we'll see that on the bill, I would guess. So we'll see it. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I believe Mr. Perkins should know this. We had that bill in Judiciary 2 years ago, and where we were limiting, forcing the sheriff to get them out, and other restrictions. So I thought somehow I already got past this point, but just an interesting point that we're back in the same boat again 2 years later.
I think that, I mean, we had that discussion. We also had, we did pass that. I thought we did pass it. But as with most things, if you have a sheriff that does that to you, I mean, there's no penalty associated with not doing it. So not all counties were reporting, and there's not particularly a way that you can, I mean, we can take another step and you can talk about
not paying the bill.
Direct funding or something like that if you want to go there, but, you know, that may be an uphill battle.
Mr. Chairman, next unit is page 228. This is the outpatient mental health unit that I spoke about earlier. Again, the total budget in this unit is almost $42 million. As you can see, it's mostly general fund. There is a little bit of tobacco funds in this budget. No exception request. The governor approved the standard budget as submitted. The next unit is unit 2.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair.
So, Tom, if we were to ask places where we could spend less money, this might be one of them, if you look at it, as far as this program goes.
That's just what the outpatient is, one of the offsets.
It's... Yes, in terms of the overall mental health and substance abuse area, we feel that there's opportunities to have cost savings. But with the idea that we could move the money over and the community mental health organizations wouldn't suffer because they'd be able to find funding through private insurance and or through Medicaid billings.
The other thing, Mr. Chairman, is the way it works. And I don't know if this is the correct budget or not, but I've had some discussion out there, and we've communicated with you about whether you have the mental health providers are able to bill under Medicaid, and so they get that's not credited against what they receive from the state because of some privacy issues. I know there was a bill out there to try to deal with it. So someone goes into the system, then the mental health providers get the state's money, then they also bill Medicaid, and so they get that money as well, and it's not showing up anywhere in terms of an offset. Is that where this money, is that where this would be happening in this area, or is it another part of the mental health and substance abuse?
It would be in those four main areas that we've talked about. So it's scattered throughout. It's just not in just one area. So
I guess the question is, does that happen?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, as I was told, as prior to my time, is that the department made a suggestion that there would be a Social Security number or some type of identifier that we could run against check to see if, in fact, there would be double billing, for lack of a better term. That was rejected. So consequently, at this point in time, there is no mechanism in place that we can make a run against Medicaid database and the community mental health database to see if, in fact, we're being charged for the same person for the same services.
Let me ask it another way, Mr. Chairman. So I go in, and I can go into one of those services providers, and I qualify under the state program. Can I also go in and be qualified under Medicaid, so I could be reimbursed both ways?
That is possible, Mr. Chairman.
So what, we don't know if that's $5 or $5 million or anything about the size of that, then, I guess is what you're saying, or how much of it really goes on.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, you're absolutely right. It could be very small. It could be very large. We just don't know.
Okay.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What are the qualifications under this program? Are they income-based? I'm just curious as far as treatment under this for this $41 million, or is it just a direct payment to the community providers for their operation?
Mr. Chairman, again, these are community mental health organizations. Right. They are independent businesses. And the board of directors, and they provide a whole array of services to a whole array of people.
Yeah.
You can be totally, it's not dependent upon your income status. So a person could have a significant income, they could have no income. They take one, they take all. The question then is the billing, and do they bill the individual for the services, or do they just use the state support for it? There's a combination of there. How all the mix is depends on which region or which facility that you're talking about in terms of how extensive a billing practices they have or don't have in place. So I would guess that some are using primarily the state funds, some are using a much more robust collection system, in terms of insurance.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the follow-up, if I may?
Yep.
I'm just trying to figure out what qualifies the local, and let's just say it's the local one here in Cheyenne that's got a few outreaches around this area, for them to send a bill to the state to access part of this $41 million, what qualifications do they have to meet with the state to access the $41 million? And I should know this. I probably didn't when I was on labor 12 years ago, but I just need a little refresher.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Chris Newman to get into a little bit more of the specifics because you're kind of digging down into it, and I believe I know the answer, but I'd rather have her answer it just to make sure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, the Community Mental Health and Substance Abuse Centers are reimbursed through a block grant, as the director said. So they have to, we actually have notices out now that it's time to apply again for any interested provider. We then go through a selection process and choose for counties who's going to be that provider. We use a formula to determine pretty much population. Do I need to stand up?
I didn't follow Don's rules, so sorry. The formula is based on population and several other factors of what the block grant amount they would get. So they basically get 1/12 payments throughout the year for providing the services. They are required to report what they're providing in a database or system we have. And by service, we don't have unique identifiers, but we can identify the person, so it's a code. So we do know what services are providing. We do know on a more aggregate level what insurances, if they do have. So we have some of that information, but we can't crosswalk that to say, if I'm a Medicaid client and I'm getting therapies there, but I'm also getting some day services, the therapies may be covered under Medicaid, but the day service I'm getting may not. We can't break it down to that to know what would be covered. And so what we are aware of is that about 30% of the clients that are being served there have at some point it's been reported that they have Medicaid. So now we're starting to dig deeper into that to try to figure out of that how many of those services would Medicaid cover for those people. And then is it more than what we should be paying them, and that's 1/12 payment. So it's not a simple analysis to go through all that, because the whole system was set up where basically they had an open door, they were out there serving whoever needed the help, and they were getting these block grants payments.
So Mr. Chairman, a follow-up, it's like
yep.
if you got one center that services a population area of 100,000, they get a per capita allotment of the total population served in the state. Is that how it works?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, correct. So there's a formula.
Okay.
So you would see that, for example, the provider here has a much larger budget serving the areas that they serve than the provider perhaps up in Bighorn County that doesn't have the population there. And the numbers verify that. The numbers they report to us, they are serving significantly fewer people up there than the provider here in this area. And so they're not receiving the same amount of funding for that.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's just a state direct subsidy payment. And if we're going to, I guess, Director, if we're going to realize any at some point in time, if we do expand our Medicaid, then we're going to have some analytical tool to make a determination about how we can reduce basically the base block grant based on some kind of a formula of their gross or the number of people that they're serving. And we've got to develop that tool, I guess, to fairly reduce the base block grant then.
Senator Meyer, that is correct. What we anticipated as for in our offset review is that there's no way we could reduce all funding. So we looked at stepping it down by 50% over a four-year period of time. But they would then be able to have this block grant, but then they'd be able on the other side to bill insurance, private insurance, and Medicaid. And so that was the thinking. But again, right now it's essentially a block grant to each of these facilities based on this formula.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up and then I'll leave the topic. Do we have a baseline established prior to ACA implementation as far as the client served per provider?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, while we're on that subject, the block grant, is there an MOU or a contract that you enter with these providers? And so is it fee for service, or is it just I'm going to give you $5 million and if you happen to have 100 clients, that's okay? If you have 300 clients, you get the same amount of money. And the other part of that is if they don't get to that level, what the block grant calls for in terms of the number of people or services they provide, does that money revert back? And then there's also another part of that that's called some kind of a catch-all, that even though we do all this, we're just going to give you another X amount of money, and I forget the terminology of it, and to spend on other things. And then, in fact, is that not spent? Does that come back?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, I will ask again Chris to get into the specifics there.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, I think I'm going to forget one of your question, so I'll do the best I can. So with the block grant, we do have contracts that are very specific to what services they're providing, and to we set a threshold for how many clients and how many services they have to provide.
So right there, if they provide fewer clients, do they give you money back?
Correct. So what we've written into the contract in the last several years is that if they don't meet that requirement, that threshold, then we withhold the payments at the end of the contract year. So we will not pay them above that.
It's written to incentivize them to be sure and bring the people in then, right?
Correct.
Okay, have you thought about reversing that? So the incentive is not to bring them in, is to be more efficient?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, we're actually looking, I agree with that approach. We're looking to revamp the entire way we do that system.
Good.
So not just a small change like that. So we're actually looking, and we have an internal group with some providers saying we need to move in a different direction to reimburse for these services. So it's still very early on, but our plan is that we will not, I think as the director alluded to, we still know we need to use some state general funds for those what we would call wraparound services that people with serious mental illness need. I mean, they have functional challenges every day they need help with, and there isn't a health insurance company that's covering those types of service. So we understand that for those, we want to serve that core group. We feel like that's the state's role. But how we reimburse for that, how we assure that we're going to focus more on the outcomes, is that person improving? Are they able to get a job? Are they able to have stable housing to function without relying on services for the rest of their lives as intensely as they're getting maybe at that point? So that's the direction we're trying to go.
And, Mr. Chairman, you'll look at that Medicaid component as well in case they're getting double-dipping or whatever you want to call it as part of this study you're doing?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Co-Chairman, we actually have Medicaid on that group, and they're helping pull that data and do that evaluation.
Okay. Sorry about that. Oh, that's all good. Okay, moving on.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think we're on page 287. Is that right? I'm just kidding.
A little bit shy of that. I think about 227.
Okay. It just feels like it, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Next unit is on page 230, and this is our outpatient substance abuse unit. Again, no exception request. This was broken out from the unit 2502, and the governor did approve the standard budget as submitted. And just note that the total budget's about $19 million, and about 8.4 of that is tobacco funds.
Okay.
Next unit is on page 233. This is residential mental health. And again, no exception request. The governor did approve the standard budget as submitted, and there are no tobacco funds supporting this program. The next unit is on page 235. That is the residential substance abuse, again broken out from 2502. No exception request. The governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. And you will note that there is a small amount, almost $27 million budget, and $2.9 million of that is tobacco funds, the rest being general fund.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just a question. When we look at, again, as we look at trying to be effective as and efficient as we can with these funds, are we looking to see, I've seen some data that would indicate that a lot of times intensive outpatient therapy is oftentimes as successful or as beneficial as inpatient therapies. And I'm wondering, but yet residential substance abuse treatment is much more expensive. So I'm just wondering, are we doing anything to look at that to see if we can develop efficiencies and make sure we're implementing best practices with respect to our residential substance abuse money?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins. There is a lot of things that we need to take a look at within the department, and this particular area is one of them. it's on the radar screen, as Ms. Newman said, that we are starting some discussions on the contracting and where we want to take the system forward. It just is not that high right now in terms of coming up with some recommendations. Frankly, with the things I reported on earlier today, have taken our time, and we're going to get to this area as well as some others, but it's going to take some time.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Hey, Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration is on page 237. This is the Spree School Services unit that we spoke about. There is no exception request, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. Mr. Chairman, the next unit is on page 242, and
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Representative Stubbs.
We go back real quick just to make sure that we were, Mr. Chairman, Director, we were talking earlier today about the statutory requirement of essentially the calculation, per child calculation that goes to the preschool DD program, and I know, so we did not include that additional funding last time around, and there was a cut, and I think we had in the final budget some language here, regardless of the statute, here's the amount we're going to pay, and just in developing your budget this time around, again, were you working off that statutory direction on what that per child amount should be? Or how was that calculated?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, we were operating off of the fact that we had $1.4 million reduction in there for 14 that was biannualized for 15-16.
And so, Mr. Chairman and Director, I would assume then we would probably need similar language in this budget if we followed this recommendation, essentially acknowledging that this is this funding is being done sort of in lieu of what the statutory funding would require. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, the way what I took off from this morning's meeting is that we're going to be looking at this whole issue, trying to get some answers in terms of maintenance of effort issues back to you before your markup for your consideration.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for consideration is on page 242. This is respite care. This is 100% general fund, and it basically covers respite care while people are waiting to get on the waiver if they require it. And, again, there is no exception request, and the governor approved the standard budget as submitted. The next unit is on page 245. This is the Wyoming Life Resource Center. Again, the governor approved the standard budget as submitted, and there are exception requests.
This is the same, Mr. Chairman, as the state hospital. We need 334,000 dollars. It's page 246, 247, and this is to purchase equipment, or basically equipment replacement. This would come from the land fund. The current balance of the land fund is 739,000. 225. So we're drawing that down, and at some point that's going to have to be replenished, but for this biennium we won't need any general fund money. Again, this pays for replacement of equipment like in household goods, food service, medical lab, etc.
Questions? You know, and Don, I know we had the same report last year. Really, all these funds, all these constitutional funds and land funds, we'll want to take another look just to kind of refresh our memory. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, then moving on 240, page 249, it's the capital construction, and this is, we had initially put in a request for $10,272,214 as a placeholder to begin this construction or discussion of construction. The governor elected to replace it with $30 million, and so, again, this would be a placeholder to start the discussions on where we want to go with our facilities and then having some money available to begin that work once the decision is made on what we want for the future. And without putting money into the budget, then what we'll be talking about is going through this process, then coming back a year from now or 2 years from now and asking for the money, and it's just going to be multiple years down the road. And this is at least get us started, and we have some money set aside that will be there when the decision is made. This is where we want to go with the facilities. And in terms of the proper amount for each facility, I can't even tell you that is the proper amount at this point. It's just a matter of you've got the state hospital and the Life Resource Center is the two with the highest priority, and the vet's home is the third.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is perhaps a little more, Director. It just seems like there's so much in question with this, with the WLRC. It's just so much in question, yet we're still placeholding money for it. Is wisdom in that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we are placeholding, again, money, one-time money for reconstruction. The reason why I'm hesitant to say this is exactly what we need is, again, as I mentioned this morning, is what's the vision? Do we just want to replace what's there right now? And or do we want to take it in a new direction, a different direction? And if I think that needs some discussion among some people to say, this is the proper role of the state, this is where we want it to go, not only today but for the future. This is a role we don't want the state to be in. Before we just jump in and start reconstructing facilities as they exist today. And so initially we had $10 million essentially in for this, and the governor came back and said, no, I'd like to have us have money for all three facilities and start that discussion. And this is not, and again, the study came out was 80 plus million for phase one and about 70 million for phase two. So this is just a beginning or a down payment on it, depending on which way you all decide is we want the facilities to go.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that completes the Behavioral Health Division.
Okay. One quick, Senator Meyer.
Over on 252, we got our 419 there, and you're saying we got 45 people of the 419 that we haven't had hired for a while. Is that what we heard earlier today?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we've put a freeze essentially on most position vacancies until the determination is some decisions are made. And so I'd be uncomfortable to say strip it out right now, because until you decide where that facility is going, I would not jump in to just eliminate them. But we're not going to refill them until we have a clear direction on where that facility should be, not only today but for the future.
Mr. Chairman, I think a couple of years ago we had a directive, and I don't know if you were, your department was spared that anything that was, you know, vacant more than 2 years we stripped out. So were you spared that knife at that time?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, what they have exempted, in effect, direct care staff. So that would be primarily at these facilities.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But just because they're vacant is we're not going to fill them, because we think that as it's currently established is that we're overstaffed, and we can compress that workforce. But as I mentioned this morning, I just have a director. This is his first day. So to
right.
jump in and make all these decisions, I want him to be up there and look through and make sure that he's comfortable with what where we think we can go.
Mr. Chairman, to recap, I think what we've heard is that we're 45 people that aren't hired there, and I believe there was a discussion of 90 people that you could reduce. Is a 45 in that 90, or is that in addition to the 90?
I think it was 117.
117.
And, yes, that's 45 would be part of that number.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman and Senator Meyer, I guess for the whole committee, what you had is two different things coming together almost at the same time. One was the study that was requested by the legislature and in terms of the transitioning people out of that facility as well as looking at efficiencies. On the other side, you had this comprehensive review of the facilities themselves, and they're coming together. I think it's fortunate that they've come together, and so now we just have to, somebody has to make some decisions, and that's where I would like to know who I should sit down with to discuss the future of these facilities with. I mean, you just take a look at the Pioneer Home in Thermopolis. That's an assisted care facility. Should the state be in the assisted care facility business? Or should it we look at spinning it off? I mean, just is it a proper role? It's not serving as a safety net. It is a facility. I mean, I can go through each of the facilities and say, what is the proper role for these facilities and really for the state of Wyoming to do? But I sit there and I ask the questions and amongst ourselves, but who do I have the discussions with? I think it needs to be decided at the elected officials level, but should it be with the JAC? Should it be with the Labor Committee? Should it be a small select group? I would like some direction because I think we're talking multi-million dollars decisions that need to be made, and before we make them, we need to have some clarity on where we're going.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I sense a little frustration there, and I can understand that. The governor's office obviously would be one of them. That have you spoken with the governor about his thoughts on this? And maybe there's a way to at least have a plan. Nothing's going to happen this session, but if there's some support you need from the legislature, I think what you're talking about, what you want to do, makes all kinds of sense. How can you move forward and spend millions of dollars if you don't have a plan? We don't know where we want to go, what we want to do, how we want to get there. So if we're going to do all of that, we ought to have an idea. And so if there's some thoughts or things we could do with this committee to help facilitate that, Mr. Co-Chair, I don't know how you feel, but I think that's very reasonable. We can't expect you to make political decisions and then come around and say, why did you do that? That's what we're supposed to do. You know, we're supposed to make those and then help, and your help us implement them. So if there's some things there we need to do to get this moving, I think that's a reasonable request.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, if you want us to come forward with a recommendation, be happy to do that. I just need to know who to have the discussion with.
Mr. Chairman.
Better.
Mr. Chairman, these are legitimate concerns. He's talking about facilities that perhaps outlived their time or their purpose. Much has changed since their original construction and what they were set up for. I think we have to answer that question. Who gives the director the answer? Does it come from our committee, from the governor's office? Where does it come from? And I think before we continue to throw money at it and spend money with it, there needs to be some decisions made.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Moniz.
If I could just follow up, has there been any discussion with the Labor Health Committee on this particular issue? Because I would think they should be also involved in this discussion.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, what we have presented the report on the Life Resource Center, that the legislative mandated study to that committee. The overview of the facilities at a very high level was given also to the committee, but we didn't have the report completed at that point. That has been forwarded to them, and so the discussion has started with that committee. But that the money flows through this committee. And so, consequently, I think it's important to have some type of discussions with this committee. And then how we go forward with the planning is, I'll be happy to come back with a recommendation if that's what the committee would like.
Mr. Chairman, I'll discuss it with
the governor.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd recommend that we have Director Forslund give us a request or a recommendation on how we should proceed here.
Mr. Chairman, we're now moving to the Aging Division. The first unit for consideration is actually on page 254. This is Aging Administration. There are no exception requests, and the governor, it looks like we're missing the governor's approval for the standard budget as submitted. But I'm sure he did.
Well, Brett's back, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, don't mess with my budget analyst, please. Mr. Chairman, the next unit is on page 258. That's the senior care unit. The governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted, and there is an exception request.
Mr. Chairman, the request is for $200,000 to support the ADRC. This would be $200,000 from the general fund. This would to cover the biennial costs of the Aging and Disability Resource Center. This is a program that was originated and has been running for a few years, but there's never been full funding for it for a biennium. So we have to come in and ask for half the funding periodically. So what is in the budget right now is $200,000. We're requesting that to go to $400,000. And that then be part of the standard budget if we wish to keep the program going. At this point in time, if the budget is approved as it is, we only will go through fiscal year 2015, and then we'll have to end the program. The purpose of the program is to try to divert, The purpose of the program is to help family members find options for their parents or their loved ones, and so they don't think that the only option out there for them is a nursing home. Now, it might be an appropriate setting for their parent, but there are other options available also, and this organization and this program, I should say, helps counsel and work with family members to help them find out what the options are for their parent, and so the family member can make the appropriate decision. Since the inception of the program, there is a potential cost savings of $4.9 million. However, there are other programs I think play a part in that, but to show you the difference is a placement in a nursing home at this point. Average cost is $65,000 a year. The average cost of long-term care waiver is $15,000 a year. So just from a Medicaid perspective, if the decision and the option is made available for a long-term care waiver, that is $50,000 a year savings to the Medicaid program. So certainly this program contributes to the overall efforts to educate family members and give family members opportunities to a whole array of opportunities that are available to people in Wyoming so they don't think the only recourse is to send dad or mom to the nursing home.
those are some of the same services I think that senior centers offer in other parts of the state. This program is primarily located just in the southwest part of the state, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, this is a statewide program, but the contractor is based out of Southwest. Some of the senior centers do provide this service. Some do not. Most of them do not. So consequently, this is, again, I don't think there's just one program that does all for everybody in the state. This program contributes to the overall efforts of educating and assisting family members making the appropriate decisions.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up. Is this the area where we have our grants to our senior centers in this particular budget? Is this the area, not this $200,000 or $400,000, but is this the area where we have our grants to the senior centers in this area?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, no. This has nothing to do with the nursing homes. The senior centers and funding for senior centers.
Right, the $200,000 or the $400,000 that you want biannualized doesn't have anything to do with senior centers, but this aging division here, or senior care, is that where we have our senior centers also?
Yeah, it's not not the ADRC money. It's in.
Right.
Let me explain that. You go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer. There are payments. Senior centers do get paid from this budget,
right,
but generally it's for home health services they're coordinating and providing. The block grant money to senior centers is in a different unit.
Is in a different unit, okay.
Right.
All right, thank you. Just make sure when we get there we'll talk about biannualization. And I guess, Mr. Chairman, on this particular $200,000 here, you're asking it to be biannualized. Did the last year's budget request a biannualization of this figure?
Mr. Chairman, last year, and Senator Meyer, last year was to pay for the 1 year. It keeps getting 1 year funding.
Right.
And so last year was to complete that biennium. This one now, and so when the budget is pulled over, it was pulled over because it was one-time funding last year, so they only brought over $200,000 for the biennium. We still need $400,000 if we want to run the program the whole biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, well, why would we want to, if either not even funded or funded for both years, right?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, yes. I would say either
zero
the plug on the whole thing or fund it, but don't. Otherwise, we just keep coming back each year saying, could we have one more year's funding?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for considerations on page 262, this is the Nutritional Services Unit. No exception requests. The governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. The next unit for considerations on page 265, this is the Title VII Elder Rights Program. Again, no exception request, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. The next unit for consideration is on page 268, the Senior Volunteer Service Program. No exception request, the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. The next unit for consideration is on page 271. This is the Wyoming Senior Services Board. There is no exception request, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I recall that in our budget last year we put forth, I think, $200,000 in the last biennium, and none of that $200,000 was carried over, and none of it was there, and so it wasn't even biannualized. Yet the other one that we just talked about, it's a situation where I'm trying to understand the budget process, where one's carried forward and one's not carried forward. I had thought that when that came into us that it was probably going to be left in the budget and biannualized and come back as $400,000 in this. I think we've had some discussion, and Brett might share some light on that. But you know, that I see the Senior Services Board's doing a lot of the same work as, you know, at least in our area, as what the ARDC does in the other part of the state. So maybe some discussion on that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to Mr. Jones.
Want me to explain it? Mr. Chairman and Senator Myers, since I guess we have a technical difficulty over on the east side of the room, I will try to explain what happened with this process. In our 2014 budget cuts, we had recommended and submitted a cut of about, I think it's $485,000 for the senior centers. And this would be out of this unit, the Wyoming Senior Services Board. And what they do is they manage this fund, they have a board, and they distribute the funds to the various centers based upon a formula. On the floor, a budget amendment was proposed in both houses, or both chambers, I should say, that reinstated $200,000 of that budget cut. At that point in time, there was no clarity as to whether the budget cuts would be biennialized or not. And I think in the amendment, I don't think there was any language in the budget amendment regarding whether it's one time or biennialized. Later, I think it was in the preparation of this budget, a decision was made that we should biennialize those cuts. So there's additional $485,000 that was cut for fiscal year 16 to make the total $970,000. But the $200,000 that was added back was carried forward, but there wasn't an additional $200,000 of the refunding carried forward with it. So I actually happened to look at this specific budget the other day and did the math, and that's how I got there to what the current budget is.
I guess some clarity on the ARDC. Was there language that specifically said that that was going to be contained in this year's budget, and whether that was going to be biannualized or not? Seems like we're splitting hairs here.
Mr. Chairman, the $200,000 of ADRC went through a budget request for this committee, and originally in the budget session, there was $200,000 that was approved for one-time funding only, and the governor recommended that the department come back and demonstrate the value of this program. When that, we did bring that to the governor, provided him with the information related to the program, and we then submitted another request for $200,000 for the second year of this current biennium. That's the $200,000 that was carried forward, but it wasn't biennialized either. So that's why we have to make an additional request for $200,000.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we'll have some more discussion on this during markup.
Okay, next.
Mr. Chairman, the next unit for considerations on page 274. This is healthcare licensing and surveys, no exception request, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. The next unit for considerations on page 278 is the Pioneer Home in Thermopolis. No exception request, and the governor did recommend approval of the standard budget as submitted. The next to last unit is on page 282. That's the Veterans Home. Again, the governor approved the standard budget as submitted, and there is an exception, or actually there are exception requests, technically.
And Mr. Chairman, there's a couple items here. First one is $420,000 for the Veterans Home, and this is for Veterans Home Pharmaceuticals. And this is to cover the cost of pharmaceutical for the residents of the facility. And this is what I was mentioning to you this morning, where the federal government has ceased paying for or providing those the pharmaceuticals to the residents, and now that facility has to pick up the cost. That's the amount that we think that's going to be needed to pay for that.
You know, Director, this morning when you said that, and now it's going to come out of what the federal government justified that. You said the term's going to come out of just the basic fee. How did you say that this morning?
They pay the state on a per diem basis.
Per diem.
Mm-hmm. Per person.
So the per diem is not enough to cover this then?
Mr. Chairman, no. And the per diem is not enough to cover the whole cost of running the facility.
Even running it, sure.
So consequently, the we need some general fund support to run that facility, as well as add this added cost now to it.
So with a different object code, then you'll account for this separately then. I mean,
Mr. Chairman,
it's just going to that, really.
Mr. Chairman, the way the Veterans Home works is that it's 100% funded with general fund. There are some donation and trust and agency funds. And any funds collected, whether it be the Veterans Administration per diem or the resident contribution, and there is a resident contribution there as well, those are deposited back into the state general fund.
General fund.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we receive approximately $2.3 million in revenue for the facility. It costs us approximately $3.4 million to operate, and this was for fiscal year 13. So we needed a general fund support of approximately $1.2 million.
Okay. Thank you.
The second item, Mr. Chairman, is just a continuation of what we've talked about quite a bit today, and that is Governor had recommended $15 million for facility upgrades. And that, through the combination of the three that I've talked about, that's $60 million.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the last unit at
4:30. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. When
Representative Stubbs.
Quick. I don't want to get done too early. Mr. Chairman, just I do notice the increase in one position from your base budget to your standard budget on the Veterans Home. Is that just a reassignment? On page 286.
I'm trying to find the offset. 286. 48 to 49. Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, again, I think it's one of those net to zero transactions, and we've already agreed we're going to try to map you through all of the position movements within the Department of Health. We're going to, with the aid of the Budget Office, and they're nodding. So.
Yeah.
Bottom line, Mr. Chairman, we've asked for two positions. The governor said only one. We haven't added other positions within the department.
Mr. Chairman, the last unit in the Department of Health, it starts on page 287. This is the retirement center. Again, the governor has approved the standard budget as submitted, and there is an exception request. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to handle that exception request because I may be the only one that can understand it. The census at the retirement center has increased over the past 2 years. So there are more patients being served. There are more beds filled. So therefore, their cost increase. However, with that increase in patients, we've been able to collect more Medicaid revenue at the center. So basically, this request additional appropriation to cover the additional costs related to the increase in patients, but decreases the general fund because we have offsetting additional revenues. So the bottom line is we're increasing costs by $282,000, but we're reducing general fund by $1.1 million. So it's a net savings to the general fund, even though we're asking for more appropriation.
Mr. Chairman, this facility, as well as the others, what we're trying to do is to, in effect, determine where they are, start essentially monitoring a P&L and moving as close as we can to having them cost neutral. So we have some issues related to the revenue side. We're trying to raise revenues, and so as we raise revenues, we're going to need less general fund subsidy. But at this point, we've made progress on a couple of the facilities, and we still have rooms to go on some of the others. And that it completes the Department of Health's 15-16 budget.
No, they're not included. That the basin facility, that's not included in any kind of CapCon. That's just these other three, really.
At Mr. Chairman, at this point in time,
Buffalo, Lander, and Evanston.
It's those three that you mentioned. Recently, the facility in Thermopolis, the Pioneer Home, has been renovated. So there's not a need to do anything further there at the time being. The basin facility and essentially the retirement center, we need some clarification on where we want that facility to go. But the infrastructure itself is in pretty good shape. It just depends on what role we want it to play within the state of Wyoming.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perkins. Senator Meyer.
No, Senator Bebout.
Senator
Bebout. There's only two others.
I can't hear any of that. I thought it was somewhere over here. You guys are all starting to sound the same.
Selective hearing, Mr. Chairman. What's
Sorry
the percent utilization
no,
of basin? How many, you know, for a long time, one of the whole entire building was vacant. And is it all full now? What's the utilization factor there?
I don't have the utilization numbers or bed count with me this afternoon, Mr. Chairman or Mr. Co-Chairman, but the count is going up, and as Bob said, that we're generating more revenue. We expect to get more revenue in the future. It's a combination of patients going in there, some who need more intensive wound care, some that are from that area and just want to, family members want them there. Others are some challenging patients that other facilities have asked to them, their family members, to remove them from their facility. And we've served as a safety net for that population. That population, the last population, is we have them somewhat split between some at the retirement center and basin and some at the state hospital, depending on the severity of their mental health issues. And the question is, should we look at the basin facility as the safety net for that geropsych population? They've probably got the building capacity to do it, but we don't have the staff availability there, and that's a challenge to recruit and retain staff for that facility with those unique skills. So, that's part of the discussion on some of these more challenging patients that we have in the state. And if we truly are serving, if the role, the proper role for the state is to be a safety net facility for these populations, then where should they be placed? And so we have some, again, at Basin right now and some at the state hospital. The more severe ones are at the state hospital.
Mr. Chairman, one other thing, too, and I looked up the tobacco settlement just to get an idea. My memory is fairly close, but it's the last six more years, according to the information that I had. And it's to the tune that we spent about $55 million a year. So when you look at that, the thing I'd like to see is the breakdown of how it's spent. You know, it shows big, broad category, you know, and it's a big part of it goes to DOC. Not worried about that, just the DOH component, and particularly the advertising part. So that'll narrow that for you. Thank you.
Anything else, members? Yeah, I think you guys are still on the clock till 5, aren't you?
We got to go back to the office.
Oh. Okay, anything else? Well, we sure appreciate all your hard work getting ready and your work this past year, and I'm sure at some point we'll probably have you back again for a few questions, but appreciate all your good work and your presentation today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will wait with bated breath to
sure.
Come back.
Mr. Chairman?
Merry Christmas.
Mr. Chairman? Right here.
Senator Perkins.
Right here. I just wanted to echo that. You know, I know that that I learned that there's a new four-letter word out there this year, and it's been Director Forslund, I think, is a new four-letter word. And he's taken a lot of personal shots at stuff that the legislature directed him to do. And he's taken that from folks in Wyoming and unfortunately some folks in state government as well, including the legislature. And a lot of that stuff is, you know, I think from my perspective, it was a tremendous personal challenge, and it's been a personal sacrifice to some degree for Director Forslund to do that. And I just want him to know how much I appreciate the work the Heaney staff has done. That we tasked them with a very difficult process. They're doing great work, and to the extent we ask questions that you haven't gotten to yet, it's because we're eager for you to succeed, and just want you to know that at least from this from my perspective, you've done a great job in very difficult circumstances. I want you and your staff to know how much we appreciate that, or at least I appreciate that.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it echoes the committee, and so we appreciate it. And so we'll keep working at it and do the best we can and come to the best solution. So appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and Senator. And I just have to say that I've got a fantastic staff, and we're working and trying to accomplish what you all want us to.
Okay, very
Mr. Chairman, and one other thing. I was wondering, should we have an appropriation for Kevlar underwear for Director Forslund to help him out there?
There'll be time and markup, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Director Forslund, I was thinking earlier when you were discussing some of the mandates by the legislature, I was thinking the best way to goof us up is just to do what we told you to do.
Very good. Well, thank you, and Merry Christmas. Okay, committee, I think we're done for today.
What are we doing tomorrow?